Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavirnyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om. Very good. Welcome back. Welcome also to the students attending this class online. We continue in this final chapter of Uddhava Gita. A chapter, you remember, opens with Uddhava's question, referring to the prior chapter, which is a lot of very profound Vedantic spiritual teachings in the prior chapter. So Uddhava said, that's really hard to accomplish. And what he said specifically is to follow that, excuse me, something in my throat. To follow the path of jnanam, which was the topic in most of the prior chapter, requires a mind that is really finely tuned, capable of meditation, for sure. And Uddhava complained, it's really hard to have that kind of finely tuned mind, hard to quiet the mind, hard to concentrate the mind. So with that question, Sri Krishna turns his attention now and answers in a very simple and practical way. I think you'll appreciate that. We'll just get into the verses and you'll see. Actually, this first verse we started to see in the last class, let's return to it though. Kuryat sarvani karmani, kuryat sarvani karmani, marartam shanakai smaran, marartam smanakai smaran, mayarpita manaschittam, mayarpita manaschitto, madharmatma manoratihi, madharmatma manoratihi. We saw the first half of this verse where Sri Krishna very deftly and without blinking an eye, he introduces what is arguably the easiest spiritual practice. I would add easiest but most misunderstood. We'll see that in just a moment. And that is Karma Yoga. How does he describe Karma Yoga? He says, sarvani karmani, all actions, all deeds, kuryat, should be done hut, how, smaran, remembering me, shanakaihi, should be done slowly, deliberately, and the key word here should be done, marartam, for my sake. And I mentioned easy because you don't have to sit in a cave to practice karma yoga. In fact, arguably, you can't practice yoga sitting in a cave, sitting in an ashram, etc. You have to get engaged in worldly activities. Further, I'm sorry, give me just a moment. Marartam, this is really the focus, and this is what is so much misunderstood in the practice of karma yoga. What does it mean to act for Bhagavan's sake, to act for Sri Krishna's sake, as if Bhagavan needs something from you? You get the point, right? But isn't that our usual interpretation? When you're acting for the sake of a relative or a friend, you're doing something for them. Why are you doing something for them? Because maybe they asked you, or maybe they didn't ask you, but you saw that they needed something. So because you see they needed some help, you give them some help. Madartam? Bhagavan needs your help? This is really important to consider. The common expression, Krishnarpanam astu. Let this deed be Krishna Arpanam, an offering to Sri Krishna. What in the world does that mean? You know, if you are going to work, Krishna Arpanam astu, what is it? Isn't it just a phrase? Just words. Usually it's just words. And this is where the misunderstanding of karma yoga is so common. The only way that it could, if you're going to work, if it really is Krishna Arpanam astu, when you get your paycheck on Friday, you should sign it and put it in the hundi. That's Krishna Arpanam astu. And not just any hundi, Krishna's hundi. Not Ganapati's hundi, not Shiva's hundi. You said Krishna Arpanam astu. So that's what the words literally mean. So we have to get a more understanding. Madartam, Krishna. Obviously, Ishvara, the Lord of the cosmos, doesn't need anything. So, madartam, for the sake of you, all we need to do is add one little word to make it clear. For the sake of reaching you. That's it. Madartam means what? For the sake of you, for the sake of gaining you, for the sake of reaching you, for the sake of knowing you. That's what madartam means. So whatever you do that is madartam for the sake of reaching Ishvara, in this case Sri Krishna, then that is karma yoga. Any deed done which contributes to your process of spiritual growth is madartam. Karma yoga. So look how we begin with this most general and helpful definition of karma yoga. Karma yoga is any deed done that furthers you on your path of spiritual growth, and the goal of that path of spiritual growth being to reach Sri Krishna, madartam. So isn't it nice to have a clear starting point, and this clear starting point isn't even understood. So some people think madartam means you have to utter Sri Krishna Arpanam before doing a deed. You've heard me joke about this, I think, before. I said the Hindu bank robber, what does he say on his way in the bank? Krishna Arpanam astu. Silly, right? So it's not by these words, and it's not even dedicating. To dedicate your deeds to Ishvara, I know you've heard that 1,000 times, and it sounds beautiful, but what does it mean to dedicate? So to me, it's far more clear to understand this madartam, or Krishna Arpanam, not as dedicating your deeds, but doing your deeds for the sake of, in the sense of, for the sake of reaching. This then puts us on a solid basis for understanding karma yoga in general. And what is not karma yoga? To go to work for the sake of becoming a big shot, furthering your career, getting the advancement, getting more money, etc., etc. That's not karma yoga. But to go to work for the sake of fulfilling your responsibilities at home, for the sake of having a stable life with a roof over your head so that you can continue your spiritual practice, that becomes karma yoga. By the way, if you're going to work, this needs to be said, if you're going to work as karma yoga, which means not for the sake of the advancement and the promotion and all of that, but for the sake of fulfilling your responsibilities. If you happen to get an advancement, great, more, even more, because why not? Is that contrary to karma yoga? Is being successful contrary to karma yoga? And the answer is no, if you seek success primarily for the sake of fulfilling your responsibility. If that's your primary goal, to actually, more than that, not just fulfilling your responsibility, but fulfilling your responsibility to support you in leading a life of spiritual growth. Why did I retract my statement there about just many? This is another common misunderstanding about karma yoga. Karma yoga is to fulfill all your responsibilities, dharma. You fulfill your responsibilities. That's all you have to do. By the way, anyone who says all you have to do is, you know, it's it's not to be taken seriously. Life is not so simple, and karma yoga, spiritual life, is not so simple. So here's the counterexample. Someone who fulfills his or her responsibilities, complaining constantly about it and not thinking about Ishvara or spiritual growth at all, but they fulfill all their responsibilities. Is that karma yoga? Not even close. So, this is just to make it clear. This is not the time, by the way, for a big, long discourse on karma yoga. We have some wonderful verses ahead. So I'd like to set this aside. If you have any lack of clarity on what karma yoga really is, and if the video I published a year or two ago called The Secret of Karma Yoga, it's a short video, but it addresses all these common misconceptions, and it'll make it very clear. So if there's any lack of clarity, please look at that video so that we can move on today. So Sri Krishna now continues. Look at the last line. Maddharmatma manoratihi. One who is manorati, one whose mind is drawn towards mat dharmatma. Here, dharmatma means the body of his dharma, the body meaning the assemblage of his teachings. We had this discussion in the last class, right? We said that dharma here uniquely doesn't mean righteousness, doesn't mean property, doesn't mean many of the common meanings of dharma. Dharma here doesn't mean religion. It means teachings. So, madharma, my teachings, my techniques, my practices. And specifically, he's talking about the practice of karma yoga. So he says, madharmatma manoratihi, one who is committed to following the practice of karma yoga, as I have taught it, that person should be what? Mayi arpita manaha chittaha. Oh, here we go. He had that arpita, dedicate. You have that word again. So that person should be one whose manas and chitta, whose mind, of course, manas means mind, chitta means mind. So, maybe some slight distinction we can make. I've translated here mind and heart. That's a nice translation. So one whose mind and heart are arpita, usually translated as dedicated. Dedicated mayi, to me, arpita. What does that mean? Dedicate your mind and heart to me, when we translate arpita. The word arpita, well, let me not give a grammar lesson here, but it's often used to refer to the hub of a wooden wheel. You remember old-fashioned wheels made of wood? That's made of wood. The spokes are made of wood, and the hub in the center made of wood. So this word arpita is used to describe that hub, that which is fixed in the middle, because of which the whole wheel can function. Therefore, a better translation of arpita instead of dedicated. Again, lovely word, but what does it mean? So, a mind that is dedicated to Sri Krishna is a mind that is fixed on Sri Krishna. Okay, that's the sense. But now, Sri Krishna said this was easy. This is the easy way. What he taught in the prior chapter, that's the hard stuff. What he's teaching now in this chapter is ostensibly the easier way. Tell me, how easy is it to continually keep your mind and heart fixed on Ishvara? That's not easy at all. Then why is he saying this is the easy way? It's the easy way because the way you gain the capacity to fix your mind on Ishvara, the means is easy. Suppose someone says, it's easy to get there. You know, you're in town and you say, go to this place, it's easy to get there. Well, it's easy to get there if you have a car. If you don't have a car, it's not easy to get there. So this is an example of the former. It is easy to develop a mind that is inclined to go to Sri Krishna, inclined towards the Lord in all situations. It's easy to cultivate it, not if you have a car, if you have the right means. So the car makes it easy to get to your destination. The right means makes it easy to cultivate an attitude, cultivate a mind, cultivate a worldview in which it's easy and effortless for your mind to turn towards Ishvara, towards Sri Krishna. What does that mean? And this will surprise you. If you haven't heard me say this before, it will surprise you. Sri Krishna is referring to the most powerful spiritual practice of all. He's teaching karma yoga. But how to practice karma yoga? If karma yoga means always fixing your mind on the Lord, how to do that? So in order to practice karma yoga, you need some spiritual practice. For one practice is another practice. That's very common. Before you can reach B, you have to accomplish A. There's a sequence. Before you can study calculus, you have to study trigonometry, you have to study geometry, you have to study algebra, you have to learn long division, all of this stuff. So there's a sequence. Before you can really and truly practice karma yoga, there's a sequence. And the sequence leads you to develop this ability to turn your mind and heart towards Ishvara all the time. That's a prerequisite for karma yoga. Can I say that again? A prerequisite for the practice of karma yoga is having your mind already inclined towards Ishvara. A mind that is not inclined towards Ishvara is not capable of practicing karma yoga. Sri Krishna says, your mind and heart should be always fixed on me. So what is that prerequisite that will allow you to practice karma yoga? That prerequisite, as I hinted at a moment ago, is the most powerful spiritual practice of all. And when I tell you what it is, you'll be surprised because it's the simplest and most common. The most powerful spiritual practice of all is simply called satsanga. Honestly, satsanga, properly understood, is without doubt the most powerful practice. By the way, what are we doing right now? This is satsanga. What is it that makes this satsanga? Is because you have You're not supposed to turn Sanskrit words into English words, but I'm going to do it anyway. You have sangad. You have performed sangha, which means you have assembled. Sangha means to come together. So you have sangad, you have come together in the presence of sat. And sat has so many meanings. The most common meaning is a good person. So satsanga, sadhu sangha, association with a good person, a person who can. This is so easy. If you want to learn cooking, hang out with a cook. If you want to learn how to play tennis, have some friends who play tennis all the time. Isn't that kind of, in American English, we call that a no-brainer. It's so obvious. So if you want to make progress on a path of spiritual growth, what should you do? That's it. That is satsanga. And you say, but that's so ordinary. How can the most ordinary spiritual practice be the most powerful? One reason, there's several ways of answering that question. One reason is this. Without satsanga, what kind of progress is possible on the path of spiritual growth? Think about it just a moment. If you don't have anyone to accompany you on that path, do you think you'll stay on that path? The path of, in fact, will you even find the path if you're left to your own devices? Anything and everything we do because we have others helping us. Without any help, what could we do in life? You know, when I say without any help, you're thinking, well, wait a minute, I have all these skills, I can do this and that and the other thing. Well, didn't you have a lot of help acquiring those skills? Lots of help. My point is that we require the help of others to do anything and everything in life. If we really think about it, we require the help of teachers. We require... I'm just going to be a little silly right now. When you go for lunch today, when you go home for lunch, there'll be some food there. So what kind of help did you need to get that food? You say, Swamiji, I cooked the food myself. I didn't need any help. Okay, you cooked the food. That's nice. I'm glad you can cook. But tell me, did you go to the supermarket to get that food? Well, wasn't that some help to get the food to the market? And somebody had to grow the food? Didn't it take some help to grow the food? And then the people who are growing the food, you think they needed any help? They also needed help. Anything and everything in life, we need help. That's satsanga. It's the most natural thing in the world to take the help of others in accomplishing our goals. And again, why is satsanga called the most powerful spiritual technique? Without help, without satsanga, you will accomplish nothing. Without help in life, you'll accomplish nothing in a worldly sense. Without help in spiritual life, you'll accomplish nothing in a spiritual sense. So for this reason, satsanga, you may think of as being very ordinary spiritual practice, but in fact, the most powerful. And that's what we'll see described in the next several verses. This introduces satsanga very nicely. Let's see that. Deshan punyan ashrayeta, deshan punyan ashrayeta, madbhaktai sadhu bhishratan, madbhaktai sadhu bhishratan, devasura manushyeshu, devasura manushyeshu, madbhaktai Charitanicha, Madbhakta Charitanita. So what does he say? End of the first line. Ashrayeta. You should resort to. Literally, you should go. You should go where? Deshan, to some place. What kind of place? Punyan Deshan, a sacred place. By the way, before we talk about sacred place, look at the common sense. If you want to cook, if you want to learn how to cook, where should you go? To the living room? To the bathroom? You go to the kitchen. If you want to learn how to play tennis, where should you go? To the bowling alley, of course. I'm just pointing out how obvious it is. We just got done saying satsanga is the most powerful spiritual practice. Where should you go? So satsanga is association with sat, good people. Where should you go? Wherever those good people are. It's that simple. And where are they? They're in Punyadesha. They're in sacred places. By the way, a very lovely expression is to call Bharat, India, the Punyadesha, Punyabhumi, excuse me, Punyabhumi. But does it mean that at the edge of the country that it is a Punyabhumi? You cross don't want to make a bad joke here. You cross the line into Pakistan. We're just seeing all terrible things going on. Anyway, Pakistan, there are good people in Pakistan too. I know there's all this government's fight, right? You think a Pakistani farmer on this side and a Bharatiya farmer on this side? Bye-bye. They're friends, right? So, governments fight. Anyway, let's not get off on this tangent. So it's not just that India is a sacred land. It's beautiful to call it such, and it is, especially from ancient times. You know, 3,000 years ago, there was a profound spiritual practice going on in India. 3,000 years ago in the Middle East, 3,000 years ago in this country. So, you know, this is why it's beautiful to call India as Punyabhumi, but certainly not the only Punyabhumi. Our definition of Punyabhumi is a place where there are good people. Tell me, where are there no good people? Can you find any place where there are no good people? Or suppose we take the more restricted meaning. Sat here means sadhu. So sadhu nam sangaha satsangaha is a common definition. Association with sadhus, which means people like this. Tell me, people like this, people who have dedicated their lives to spiritual growth, where did they live? Only in India? You'd be surprised how many sadhus live in New Jersey. So by that definition, New Jersey is a Punyabhumi, full of sadhus. Because, you know, ISKCON has their sadhus here, Ramakrishna Mission has their sadhus here, Akshara Dham, they have their VSS, every group has their sadhus here. So, which means, where should you go for satsang? It's not necessary to go to India in general or Vrindavan in particular. Everyone has that idea, not everyone. Many people have that idea that Vrindavan is the place to go. If you are a dedicated Vaishnava, there's certainly a lot of benefit in going to Vrindavan, but let's be very clear. Punya Bhumi is wherever there are good people in general and good spiritual teachers in particular. And where are there no good spiritual teachers? I'm surprised. You in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, there are sadhus there, trained in India, who have their classes going on. And if there aren't, everyone is on the internet watching the finding those spiritual teachers online. And today with the internet, we have truly a global community. So holy place here doesn't mean a particular address. It's really referring to a place where you find these good people. And what kind of people? A place which is, end of the second line, Shritan, a place which is populated by whom? Sadhu bihi. Populated by good people who are madbhaktaihi, who are devoted to me. So it becomes very clear now that the satsanga we seek is so readily available now in a physical sense, almost everywhere, and in a virtual sense, everywhere, without exception. Okay. Then, devasara manushyeshu madbhakta. Yeah. To introduce the second half, one could argue, Swamiji, there are relatively few sadhus in New Jersey. There are many more sadhus in Rishikesh. So wouldn't it be better, and many more sadhus in Vrindavan? Let's go with that example. So if I have a choice between going to Vrindavan and going to New Jersey, wouldn't it be better for me to go to Vrindavan? Well, actually, I should have stayed with Rishikesh because I know Rishikesh culture. I don't know Vrindavan culture. In Rishikesh, there are all kinds of different sadhus, including those who hang out and smoke marijuana. I mean, that's what they do all day long, every day, day after day after day. This is what they do. So go to Rishikesh and hang out with them is not satsanga, right? So it's not just association with anyone wearing this dress. Sri Krishna makes it very clear. He says, madbhakta acharitani. You should be in the company of those who are acharitani, those whose conduct is madbhakta, those who are engaged in worship of me, those who are devoted to me. And he says, and if you say, well, where will I find those devoted to you? He says, deva asura manushyeshu. Amongst the devas, go and hang out with those who are dedicated to me. Amongst the asuras? Like Prahalada? He was an asura. I mean, he was a daitya. He was in that lineage. So even among the asuras, there are those who are devoted to Sri Krishna and obviously manushyeshu. So when you go to Rishikesh, you should associate with the right kind of people. And when you go to New Jersey, same thing. You associate with the right kind of people. Then, Pratak satrena vamahyam, Pratak satrena vamahyam, Parvayatra mahotsavan, Karayet gita nrityadair, Karayed Gita Nrityadar Maharaja Vibhutibhi Maharaja Vibhutihi. In the third line, Karayet, you should do. What should you do? Second line, you should do Parva, Yatra, and Mahotsava. You should participate in Parva, special days. You should participate in Yatra, not necessarily going to a sacred place, but some religious gathering. And of course, Mahotsava, the religious festivals that we celebrate. He says, Yakarayet. You should participate in all of these. I'm smiling. I'm making up another bad joke. I should stop doing that. So there are 33 crore deities in the Hindu tradition. So that means if you have a festival day for each of them, is there any day of the year which doesn't have a particular festival taking place? It's a bad joke just to illustrate the fact that special days dedicated to worship means every day. But we do have these special celebrations, and Sri Krishna says, Karayet, participate in those special celebrations, which are first line, Mahyam, which are done for me. And whether you do it pratak, separately, whether you just celebrate at home, or satrena, you do it in a group, like you go to the temple. In either case, you should karayet, participate in these festivals. How? Gita nrityadihi. You should participate with singing, as is done so often, and nritya adi, dance, etc. A lot of people criticize these ISKCON for always dancing. Hey, they've got a solid basis for dancing. This is Bhagavata Purana. Sri Krishna himself says, celebrate by dancing. So no need, no space for that kind of criticism. You should do all of that. Maharaja Vibhuti Bihi. Do it with this Vibhuti glory. What kind of glory? Maharaja, the glory of the great kings. Do it in a royal manner. Do it with lots of pomp, lots of whatever it is. Okay, then. Look how practical this advice is. Remember our context. Before you can practice karma yoga is the thing Sri Krishna is teaching here. But I said there's a prerequisite to karma yoga, and that is your mind has to have an inclination towards Ishvara. How do you create that inclination towards Ishvara? And that's where things get really easy. Satsanga, even in New Jersey, no problem. And celebrations, people, how nice. Every religion does this. You have song, and maybe, I don't know, there's singing in, I just caught myself. Is there singing in every religious tradition? This is a thing, I don't know, maybe it's my orientation as a teacher, but there are always exceptions. So I can think of at least two exceptions about singing. In very orthodox settings, in very orthodox Islamic settings, they might frown on singing. And something you may not know about, there are some Christian groups that look upon singing as being very worldly, and they prohibit any such singing. So there are some exceptions, but by and large, singing is such an essential part of every religious group for a very obvious reason. We love to sing, we love to hear sing, we love to sing, even if we don't know how to sing. we We love to sing. We love hearing singing, with some exceptions. And that person I just referred to. And when it's in a religious context, it's so much more beautiful. So how lovely that we are able to find modes of religious expression which are so dear to our hearts. Okay, then we continue. Oh, in fact, now we have a major shift in this advice. It still goes on how to create that inclination. So very practically, he says, go to a holy place where there are good people. Can I paraphrase it and say Sri Krishna says go to New Jersey because it's a holy place where there are good people. You can't deny that. All right, and then participate in whatever are the religious activities and spiritual activities like this. Now comes a turn away from external activities and towards internal activities. Sri Krishna says, Mameva sarva bhuteshu, Mameva sarva bhuteshu, bahirantarama, bahirantarapavratam, 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 ikshetatmani chatmanam, ikshetatmani chatmanam, yatha kamamalashayaha, yatha kamamalashayaha. If you read it bahir antara, you get stuck because pavratam is not a word. So it's antara apavratam. All right. First line. Mameva, Sri Krishna says, me alone, or me indeed, sarvabhuteshu, abiding in all beings. Third line, iksheta, you should see. You should discover my presence, mameva, iksheta, you should discover, mameva, my presence, sarvabhuteshu, in all beings. How? Atmani cha atmanam. You should discover my presence in all beings as Atma. And here, take a Vedantic meaning of Atma. Satchidananda Atma, consciousness. Consciousness is in you. Consciousness is in me. Consciousness is in all beings. And that consciousness is Sri Krishna. Sri Krishna says, I am that. I am that consciousness abiding in all beings. So, iksheta, one should discover, mam eva, my presence indeed, sarvabhuteshu, in all beings, one should discover atmanam. Third line, one should discover my presence as your own true self, atmani, within yourself, yatha kam. He gives a very... This is, even though that the topic here is bhakti, this is very Vedantic. Yatha kam, like space. And what's interesting about space, and why is... space is always given as a, not always, frequently given as a metaphor for consciousness, atma, and the reason usually given is that space has no barriers, has no boundaries, space is all pervasive. So just as one space is present in many rooms, one consciousness is present in many sentient beings. But that misses 50% of the metaphor. And the other 50% of the metaphor is that kam, space, is amala ashayaha. Space is an ashaya, an abode, which is amala absolutely untainted. So if there is smoke in the air or pollution, what is such a better example? When pollution fills the air, it affects our lungs a lot. How does it affect space? This is so important, that consciousness remains pure, just as space remains pure in the presence of pollution. Consciousness remains pure in the presence of our impure thoughts. I'll say that again. Consciousness, the divinity within you, remains perfectly pure in spite of any impure thoughts. That's why we call it inner divinity. Okay, now, yeah, we have time. These next two verses kind of finish off this idea very nicely. So notice how we've shifted from activities. Go to New Jersey. Step one. What is the first step of living a spiritual life? Anyway, it works. You can't deny that. Okay, we'll continue here. Iti sarvani bhutani. Iti sarvani bhutani madbhavena mahadyute. Madbhavena mahadyute. Sabhajayan manyamano. Sabhajayan manyamano. Jnanam kevalam ashrutah. Jnanam kevalam ashrutah. Iti, thus, sarvani bhutani, all beings, now go down to the third line, manyamanaha, considering them how? Sabhajayan, considering them as being worshipful. Understanding, in fact, that comes here, second line, madbhavena, manyamanaha, madbhavena, looking upon all beings as being embodiments of me, madbhavaha, and therefore all of them are sabhajayan. All of them should be treated with respect, with love. Just so I don't forget, mahadyute, O Uddhava, O Shining One, O Uddhava, all beings should be understood to have my presence within and therefore be deserving of love and respect. I'm pausing here just out of dismay, seeing how many places in the world that kind of love and respect for humanity itself is absent. The fact that human beings can treat other human beings with such a horrible lack of love and respect, the inhumanity of a portion of humanity, it's distressing when you see what goes on in Gaza, when you get the news, what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Sudan, what's going on here and there and in all these other places, it's almost incomprehensible. And the key here, what is the key? So the divinity of all living beings is a fact. It's not even a matter of belief. You know, suppose someone is not Hindu. Fine. But that person who's not Hindu, they're still a human being, right? And they have value for their life as a human being. and having such value for their life, if they're intelligent at all, they would have value for all life. So therefore, respect for the life of others doesn't depend on any particular religious belief. It is born of understanding our common humanity. Born of understanding. And that's the word Sri Krishna uses in the second line. He calls it jnanam. That is understanding. For someone outside the Hindu tradition, it would be understanding our common humanity. For someone inside the Hindu tradition, it would be understanding the essential divinity of all living beings, having Bhagavan's divine presence within them. So whether you are within the Hindu, under the Hindu umbrella, or outside of the Hindu umbrella, in either case, it depends on jnanam, not bhakti. And this may, I don't want this to sound terrible, but someone can be so full of devotion standing in front of an altar and then go outside and, Indian setup would be you finish praying inside the mandir, you come outside, and there's a line of, in some especially famous pilgrimage places, a whole line of beggars lined up there. And suppose someone goes up, a filthy beggar, and kicks the plate away, their bowl away. They just finished worshiping inside the temple. That doesn't guarantee that worshiper doesn't guarantee that the worshiper recognizes the divinity in the beggars as much as on the deity on the altar. In fact, not hard to argue that the divinity is more present in the beggars. That's stone. Of course, we invoke Ishvara's presence in it, and there's a lot more going. It's much more than stone, but it is stone, marble. So tell me, which is a better representation of divinity, stone or this line of beggars? Yet, it's possible for a devotee to come out of the temple and treat the beggars with scorn. Why are they, this is such a beautiful sacred place. Why are they sitting here? People say that. You know, without thinking. What is it then that's the key? It's the key is not bhakti. The key is what Sri Krishna says in the fourth line, jnanam, understanding. So understanding, inside, outside the Hindu tradition, understanding our common humanity. Within the Hindu tradition, understanding the divinity of all living beings. But notice, that's jnana, not bhakti. Bhakti alone is not enough. Of course, jnana alone is not enough. we need both. So that's why Sri Krishna says that jnanam. Jnanam kevalam ashutaha. The one, and this actually connects to the next verse, and we'll finish the class with the next verse. So ashutaha is talking about the saintly people who ashutaha, who are devoted to jnanam kevalam. This jnanam, this wisdom, kevalam, this particular wisdom that allows non-Hindus to see our common humanity. By the way, I'm stuck on this. If you see the common humanity of 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, who are not getting water, not getting food, the only thing they're getting is they're getting bombed. I don't get it. Where is, and I'm not taking sides. Please don't misunderstand me. That's not the I've mentioned before, the politics in that situation is horribly complex, and I don't even want to touch it. But the fact is how is the common humanity of those Palestinians not being understood? Or the common humanity of people living in Kyiv in Ukraine who are getting bombed regularly? Or, God knows, subsistence farmers in Sudan. They already have such a miserable life. And then due to a civil war, their life is made far more miserable. Anyway, this is the lack of appreciation of our common humanity for those outside of the Hindu umbrella, and for those who are Hindu. How many times have you been told we are all embodiments of the divine? This is not bhakti. This is jnanam, understanding. And what Sri Krishna continues about that jnanam, he says, Brahmano pulkase stene, Brahmane pulkase stene, Brahmanyarke spuling, spulingake, Brahmanyarke spulingake, Akrure krurake chaiva, Akrure krurake chaiva, Samadrik pandito mataha, Samadrik pandito mataha. That last line connects to the prior verse. So we talked about in the last verse, those who are, just that last line of the prior verse, those who are ashrataha, those who are in immersed in this jnanam, those who have embraced this jnanam, this kevalam jnanam, this knowledge of common humanity, or this knowledge of the divinity of all beings. Who are they? In the last line, panditaha mataha. They are considered wise. Why are they considered wise? Because they are samadrik. They see the sameness of all people. They see, if they're non-Hindu, they see the common humanity of us all. If they are Hindu, they see the common divinity within us all. And within us all means all. Go up to the top. Brahmane, it sounds like Bhagavad Gita. To see that common divinity in a Brahmana, a priest, or Pulkasa is a name for a Shudra, someone of low caste. So for one of a high caste, for one of a low caste, or for one of no caste, outcast, mlecha, like me. Just to point out, if you that word mlecha gets bantered about, and it's kind of a loaded word, just to make that observation. So whether that person is of a high caste, low caste, no caste, that divinity is a Hindu any more divine than a Muslim? It's so obvious. Okay. Also, what about stena, a thief? Even a thief. Now, you say the behavior is harmful. Absolutely. There are so many people whose behavior is harmful to others, but they are also embodiments of the divine. Embodiments of the divine who lack a moral compass and are engaged in harmful behavior. They are those who don't understand dharma, and probably those who don't have that understanding of the common humanity of us all, because why steal from others who are just like you. Further, there's a little poetry here. Brahmanye arke. So Brahmanye is a holy person. So it's pretty easy to see that divinity shining in a holy person, arke, like the sun. You see the divinity shining in the holy person like the sun. But what about in the sthena? In the sthena, the divinity is there, but spulingake, like a little spark. So in a holy person, like the shining sun, and in the sthena, like in other people, like a spark. Never absent in any situation whatsoever. So again, so akrure in compassionate people, shining like the sun. Krure in wicked people, shining like that little spark. Why is it only shining like a little spark? Because it's covered by the veil of ignorance. Remove that veil of... How did the wise person become wise? Remove the veil of ignorance. How does the unwise person become wise? Remove that veil of... How does the wicked person become good? Remove that veil of ignorance. So in this way, the ones who are truly wise, panditaha, they are wise because they are samadrik. If they're not Hindu, they see the commonality of mankind. We are all one people. And if they are Hindu, we see the divinity, essential divinity of all people. And all people means without exception under any circumstances. So some very beautiful teachings here. This is a good place to conclude our class. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our Vedanta class at 10 o'clock and satsanga question answer. That was good. Very clever. I have to learn how to score a goal. Kick it really well. Anyway, sorry. Satsanga at 11 o'clock. Come with your questions and we'll conclude with our prayers. Om Ganana Antwa Ganapatigam Vamahe Kavinga Vinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahana Shrenvan Utebesira Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Guru Ratmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanura Mardanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhagvavet Asato Ma Satgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor ma amritangamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat.